WEFT Champaign, Illinois, 90.1 FM, streaming online at weft.org. Phone number is 217-359-9338. Good morning. This is Higher Ground.
And who are you?
And I am Robert Boone.
And I'm Eunice. Buckner Boone, or Eunice Boone for short.
Okay.
Hey.
Good morning. We're just listening to the song, The Power of Love, you know. I've heard someone say that we don't have a gun rights problem in this country. We got a heart problem in this country where we don't respect or reflect our own heart and see that there's a heart in every one of us, no matter who, where, and what we are.
Mm-hmm. And so we can always refer back to love or refer to love first. Just thinking about that. Robert, thank you for being co-host today. Yeah, so let's just say we're co-hosting together today.
Okay.
And it's been a while since you've been on, right?
It seems like a long time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how does it feel to be back in the seat?
I feel good. It feels nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful day. The sun is shining. The temperature is nice. And got good company. And a wonderful place to be.
Mm-hmm. WEFT.
FM.
That's right. Champagne. There you go.
Well, higher ground.
Yeah, higher ground. That is the essence and always has been the essence of higher ground. Mm-hmm. So a sort of lineup as to what we're going to be doing. So we'll have a guest at 9 o'clock, and they'll call in. And this is Dr. Jared. I'm not sure if it's Jared or Gerard. Mm-hmm. I think it's Jared. What do you think? Jared J. Giannoli. Mm-hmm. All right. He's a medical doctor, and he did He did a paper on medical errors and how there are quite a few medical errors and that these are preventable errors and they're being underreported or they're not being reported because of various reasons. And I think you'll find this conversation interesting, and Robert's going to take the lead on that. And that will be the second hour. First hour, we want to talk about, we're going to play Bernie Sanders' speech, his live stream speech he did to the nation on a couple of,
two days ago.
Mm-hmm. And I thought it was quite good.
Mm-hmm. It was outlining his principles and platform, this program, how he sees things best for everyone.
And also for the Democratic Convention that's coming up, mm-hmm. making sure that he didn't endorse Hillary, but at the same time he talked about some of the things that have been part of the campaign and how important it is that be in the forefront of the Democratic Convention in terms of these are issues that need to be addressed, mm-hmm. Concerns that need to be addressed.
Yeah, it is part of the progressive agenda. These are things that we should be part of the platform as to what's and how we should go about doing things, not just voting and sitting back and waiting for something to happen, but being a part of it, a participant.
And I think Bernie Sanders, one of the reasons why is because I'm using this as an opportunity to play to Bernie Sanders, because I think many of the principles that Bernie Sanders espouses are the principles of higher ground, what I stand for. And it's about including everyone, because everybody is included. And we definitely have a disparity in terms of how we're being included in the process. And that it's really important that people continue to work within their own home front in terms of making sure that these problems that are remedied, are remediable? Is that such a word as that? Can be fixed, can be corrected, that this continues to be in the forefront of making a correction. And so I think this speech that he does, I think, is apropos for us to discuss afterwards.
It's enlightening. It's awakening. It makes us think what's really important.
And also one of the concerns that
we can do it.
Yeah. Another thing we're concerned about, too, is this is the anniversary a year of what happened in Charleston, the shooting. And since that time, there has been another shooting with assault rifles. But also the concern is that you keep hearing this message that it's because they're Muslims. Mm-hmm. And this is not the reason why and how that way, there's a separation of church and state, and this is in a constitution. And we'd like to discuss some of the problems that occur with that and has occurred in this country.
Because of the connection between, the forced connection between church and state.
Yes.
And the founders, whatever you know, their own personalities were, saw that there's a problem when there's a connection between the secular government and religion, no matter what that religion is.
Mm-hmm. And how maybe how we look at it is not fair. Certain religions get a pass and other religions don't. And some religions get blamed for everything that their members do or who espouse to be or say they are that particular religion. Mm-hmm. The religion gets blamed for it, but other religions may not. It's just that that person did that, but not because they were a part of a religion. So we need to talk about that. We want to talk about that. And so we've got quite a bit to talk about, huh?
Yes.
Well, I'd like to read this, Robert. This I thought was interesting. It's something that Hafiz, the poet said. And he says, I know the way you can get. That's the name of it. It says, I know the way you can get when you have not had a drink of love. Your face hardens, your sweet muscles cramp. Children become concerned about a strange look that appears in your eyes, which even begins to worry your own mirror and nose. Squirrels and birds sense your sadness and call an important conference in a tall tree. They decide which secret code to chant to help your mind and soul. Even angels fear that brand of madness that array itself against the world and throw sharp stones and spears into the innocent and into oneself. Oh, I know the way you get if you have not been drinking love. You might rip apart every sentence your friends and teachers say, looking for hidden clauses. You might weigh every word on a scale like a dead fish. You might pull out a ruler to measure from every angle in your darkness the beautiful dimensions of a heart you once trusted. I know the way you get if you had not had a drink from love's hands. That is why all the great ones speak of the vital need to keep remembering God so you will come to know and see him as being so playful and wanting to help. And so I'll just put in there, you know, God. I'm going to put that God there because God is like this far off being that, you know, you might claim to know and some might say there is not one. So what I would put there is keep remembering yourself so you continue to see yourself and being so playful and wanting to help. So, what do you think?
I agree. You know, however way you can define whatever this thing that none of us has ever seen, just like air, we breathe it. Feel it. So, what is God?
Mm-hmm.
You know, God could be life. God could be love.
God is
or
life.
Love is God.
Yeah, so, God is.
So that's something we can
everything
look at, measure and use as an energy, as a motive, as a reason for our existence. So, rather than something far out, way in the heavens somewhere. You know, that we can't really even appreciate. We can appreciate each other. And love is the appreciation of our connection to each other.
Because it says, I know the way you get when you had not had a drink of love.
Mm-hmm.
Your face hardens, your sweet muscles cramp. And also, I'd like to send out my condolences to those families, too, any family who has experienced death violently, because there's been quite a few around locally.
Yes.
It's just not a phenomenon, death isn't. How we die is still death. And so I like to send condolences to myself, because I've also experienced a death close to me and my family. So we all can remember the self. Death is something that is a natural occurrence. It's going to happen. And yet, at the same time, we don't want to overly grieve about it.
You know, sometimes we put such a finality or an importance or something about death that is going to happen, but, and not as much importance in life, which is happening. Is I think I am alive, and do I appreciate my life? Do I appreciate the life that exists around me and those who are alive around me? Then that's the essence of this thing we call life, is the appreciation and the connection between all things.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So.
Yes. Even the squirrels and birds sensed your sadness. It says, even angels fear that brand of madness that arrays itself against the world and throws sharp stones and spears into the innocent and into oneself. If you have not had a drink from love's hands.
Mm-hmm.
So remember that death is not it's a reality. It's a natural occurrence. It is. And we don't want to, as Robert says, we want to love life, live life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Be grateful.
Yeah. And grace will take care of everything. I'm trying to think, what am I hearing here? Do you hear something? I keep hearing something. I'm not quite sure what it is. It's like
some other sounds from another state, somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Voices.
Yep. Oh, well. So, let me do this announcement here. Here's a lineup for the Art Theater for the week of Friday, June 17th, 2016. Held over for the second week is Lobster, starring Colin Farrell. A movie that is receiving a lot of positive press, billed as a sci-fi romance that is as strange as it is thrillingly ambitious. For viewers with the fortitude to crack through the director's offbeat sensibilities, The Lobster is a real cinematic treat. In the cinema, Judaica series is Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, with two screenings on Sunday, June 19th, one at 11:30 and the other at 7:30 p.m. So one is at 11 a.m. and the other at 7:30 p.m. And finally, on Monday, June 20th, is Rental, Not Too Bad, sponsored by Champagne Cycle. For all current dates and times, you can go to www.arttheater.coop/full-schedule. Okay, let me see what else. Bernie? Well, you know it's 8:30. I've got to do an announcement, so I'm trying to think, if I do that now, then I guess I'm kind of getting, well, that's okay. I'm going to go ahead and play Bernie now, do the announcement afterwards. How about that? Okay, so we're going to play Bernie's live stream. It's about 20 minutes long, a little bit more than 20 minutes. Okay, Bernie, cued
up. Political and social revolutions that attempt to transform our society never end. They continue every day, every week, and every month in the fight to create a nation and world of social and economic justice. That's what the trade union movement is about.
That's what the civil rights movement is about. That's what the women's movement is about.
I've got to do this over. I got to start it again, Robert. It had gone ahead without me. Maybe that was what the back talk was. Okay, so we're going to start it again. Okay. Nope, we're not starting it again. All these little bitty things that happen here. Let me see. Okay. Please work. Nope. Robert, I've got dead air. had it queued up. No, it's not working. Oh, here it is. Nope. Let me play some music.
Never end. They continue every day, every week, and every month in the fight to create a nation and world of social and economic justice. That's what the trade union movement is about. That's what the civil rights movement is about. That's what the women's movement is about. That's what the gay rights movement is about. That's what the environmental movement is about. And that's what this campaign has been about over the past year. That's what the political revolution is about, and that's why the political revolution must continue into the future. Real change never takes place from the top on down or in the living rooms of wealthy campaign contributors. It always occurs from the bottom on up when tens of millions of people say loudly and clearly, enough is enough, and they become engaged in the fight for justice. That's what the political revolution we helped start is all about. That's why the political revolution must continue. When we began this campaign a little over a year ago, we had no political organization, no money, and very little name recognition. The media determined that we were a fringe campaign. Nobody thought we were going anywhere. Well, a lot has changed over a year. During this campaign, we won more than 12 million votes. We won 22 state primaries and caucuses. We came very close, within 2 points or less, in five more states. In other words, our vision for the future of this country is not some kind of fringe idea. It is not a radical idea. It is mainstream. It is what millions of Americans believe in and want to see happen. And something else extraordinarily important happened in this campaign that makes me very optimistic about the future of our country, something that, frankly, I had not anticipated. And that is that in virtually every state that we contested, we won the overwhelming majority of the votes of people 45 years of age or younger, sometimes, may I say, by huge numbers. These are the people who are determined to shape the future of our country. These are the people who are the future of our country. Together in this campaign, 1.5 million people came out to our rallies and town meetings in almost every state in the country. Together, hundreds of thousands of volunteers made 75 million phone calls, 75 million phone calls urging their fellow citizens into action. Together, our canvassers knocked on more than 5 million doors. Together, we hosted 74,000 meetings in every state and territory in this country. Together, 2.5 million people made over 8 million individual campaign contributions, more contributions at this point than any campaign in American history. Amazingly, the bulk of those contributions came from low-income and working people whose donations averaged $27 apiece. In an unprecedented way, we showed the world that we could run a strong national campaign without being dependent on the big money interests whose greed has done so much to damage our country. And let me give a special thanks to the financial support we received from students struggling to repay their college loans, from seniors and disabled vets on Social Security, from workers earning starvation wages, and even from people who were unemployed. In every single state that we contested, we took on virtually the entire political establishment, U.S. senators, members of Congress, governors, mayors, state legislators, and local party leaders. To those relatively few elected officials who had the courage to stand with us, I say thank you. Thank you, and we must continue working together into the future. This campaign has never been about any single candidate. It has always been about transforming America. It is about ending a campaign finance system which is corrupt and allows billionaires to buy elections. It is about ending the grotesque level of wealth and income inequality that we are experiencing, where almost all new wealth and income goes to the people on top, where the 20 wealthiest people own more wealth than the bottom 150 million Americans, half our population. It is about creating an economy that works for all of us, not just the 1%. It is about ending the disgrace of Native Americans who live on the Pine Ridge, South Dakota reservation, having a life expectancy lower than many third world countries. It is about ending the incredible despair that exists in many parts of this country, where, as a result of unemployment and low wages, suicide, drugs, and alcohol, millions of Americans are now dying in a historic way, in an ahistoric way, at a younger age than their parents. Think about it. People today, by the millions, dying at a lower age than their parents. It is about ending the disgrace of having the highest level of childhood poverty of almost any major country on earth, and having public schools in inner cities that are totally failing our children, where kids now stand a greater chance of ending up in jail than ending up with a college degree. It is about ending the disgrace that millions of undocumented people in this country continue to live in fear and are exploited every day on their jobs because they have no legal rights. It is about ending the disgrace of tens of thousands of Americans dying every single year from preventable deaths because they either lack health insurance, have high deductibles, or cannot afford the outrageously high cost of the prescription drugs they need. Tens of thousands of Americans dying needlessly. It is about ending the disgrace of hundreds of thousands of bright young people unable to go to college because their families are poor or working class, while millions more struggle with suffocating levels of student debt. It is about ending the pain of a young single mother in Nevada, in tears, telling me that she doesn't know how she and her daughter can make it on the $10.45 an hour she earns. And the reality that today millions of our fellow Americans are working at wages that are much, much too low. It is about ending the disgrace of a mother in Flint, Michigan, telling me what has happened to the intellectual development of her child as a result of excessive lead in the water in that city, of many thousands of homes in California and other communities where people are unable to drink the polluted water that comes out of their faucets. In America, in the year 2016, in a nation whose infrastructure is crumbling before our eyes. It is about ending the disgrace that too many veterans still sleep out on the streets, that homelessness is increasing, and that tens of millions of Americans, because of a lack of affordable housing, are now paying 40, 50% or more of their limited incomes to put a roof over their heads. It is about ending the disgrace that in a given year, corporations making billions of dollars in profit avoid paying a nickel in federal taxes because they stash their money in the Cayman Islands and in other tax havens. This campaign is also about defeating Donald Trump, the Republican candidate for president. After centuries of racism, sexism, and discrimination of all forms in our country, we do not need a major party candidate who makes bigotry the cornerstone of his campaign. We cannot have a president who insults Mexicans and Latinos, Muslims, women, and African Americans. We cannot have a president who, in the midst of so much income and wealth inequality, wants to give hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the very, very rich. We cannot have a president who, despite all of the scientific evidence, believes that climate change is a hoax. The major political task that together we face in the next 5 months is to make certain that Donald Trump is defeated and defeated badly. And I personally intend to begin my role in that process in a very short period of time. But defeating Donald Trump cannot be our only goal. We must continue our grassroots effort to create the America that we know we can become. And we must take that energy into the Democratic National Convention on July 25th in Philadelphia, where we will have more than 1,900 delegates. I recently had the opportunity to meet with Secretary Clinton and discuss some of the very important issues facing our country and the Democratic Party. It is no secret that Secretary Clinton and I have strong disagreements on some very, very important issues. It is also true that our views are quite close on others. I look forward in the coming weeks to continued discussion between the two campaigns to make certain that your voices are heard and that the Democratic Party passes the most progressive platform in its history and that Democrats actually fight for that agenda. I also look forward to working with Secretary Clinton to transform the Democratic Party so that it becomes a party of working people and young people and not just wealthy campaign contributors. A party that has the guts to take on Wall Street, the pharmaceutical industry, the fossil fuel industry, and the other powerful special interests that dominate so much of our political and economic life. As I have said throughout this campaign, the Democratic Party must support raising the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour and create millions of jobs rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. We must ensure that women will no longer make 79 cents on the dollar compared to men, and that we fight for pay equity. We must also fight to make certain that women throughout this country have the right to control their own bodies. We must protect the right of our gay brothers and sisters to marriage equality in every state in America. As the recent tragedy in Orlando has made crystal clear, we must ban the sale and distribution of assault weapons, end the gun show loophole, and expand instant background checks. We must defeat the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, and make certain that bad trade deals do not get a vote in a lame duck session of Congress. The TPP must not come to the floor. We must resist all efforts to cut Social Security and, in fact, expand benefits for our senior citizens and disabled veterans. We must understand that the greed, recklessness, and illegal behavior on Wall Street has to end, that we need to pass a modern-day Glass-Steagall legislation, and that we need to break up the biggest financial institutions in this country, who not only remain too big to fail, but who prevent the kind of vigorous competition that a healthy financial system requires. We must aggressively combat climate change and transform our energy system, move to energy efficiency and sustainable energy, and impose a tax on carbon. It means that, further, we must protect our water supply by banning fracking. We must compete effectively in a global economy by making public colleges and universities tuition-free and substantially reduce student debt. We must join the rest of the industrialized world and guarantee health care to all of our people as a right, not a privilege. We must end the disgrace of having more people in jail than any other country on earth and move toward real criminal justice reform at the federal, state, and local levels. We must pass comprehensive immigration reform and provide a path toward citizenship for 11 million undocumented people. We must take a hard look at the waste, cost overruns, and inefficiencies in every branch of government, including the Department of Defense. And we must make certain that our brave young men and women in the military are not thrown into perpetual warfare in the Middle East or other wars that we should not be fighting. But the political revolution means much more than fighting for our ideals at the Democratic National Convention and defeating Donald Trump. It means that at every level, we continue the fight to make our society a nation of economic, social, racial, and environmental justice. It means that we can no longer ignore the fact that, sadly, the current Democratic Party leadership has turned its back on dozens of states and has allowed right-wing politicians to win elections in some states with virtually no opposition, including some of the poorest states in our country. The Democratic Party needs a 50-state strategy. We may not win in every state tomorrow, but we will never win unless we recruit good candidates and develop organizations that compete effectively in the future. We must provide resources to those states which have so long been ignored. Most importantly, the Democratic Party needs leadership which is prepared to open its doors and welcome into its ranks working people and young people. That is the energy we need to transform the Democratic Party, take on the special interests, and transform our country. Here is a cold, hard fact that must be addressed. Since 2009, some 900 legislative seats have been lost to Republicans in state after state throughout this country. In fact, the Republican Party now controls 31 state legislatures and controls both the governor's mansions and state houses in 23 states. That is unacceptable. We need to start engaging at the local and state level in an unprecedented way. Hundreds of thousands of volunteers helped us make political history during this last year. These are people deeply concerned about the future of our country and about their own communities. Now we need many of them to start running for school boards, city councils, county commissions, state legislatures, and governorships. State and local governments make enormously important decisions, and we cannot allow right-wing Republicans to increasingly control them. I hope very much that many of you watching tonight are prepared to engage at that level. Please go to my website at BernieSanders.com/win to learn more about how you can effectively run for office or get involved in politics at the local or state level. I have no doubt that with the energy and enthusiasm our campaign has shown, that we can win significant numbers of local and state elections if people are prepared to become involved. I also hope that people will give serious thought to running for statewide offices and the United States Congress. We need new blood in the political process, and you are that new blood. And when we talk about transforming America, it is not just about elections. Many of my Republican colleagues believe that government is the enemy, that we need to eviscerate and privatize virtually all aspects of government, whether it is Social Security, Medicare, the Veterans Administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Postal Service, or public education. I strongly disagree. In a democratic, civilized society, government must play an enormously important role in protecting all of us and our planet. But in order for government to work efficiently and effectively, we need to attract great and dedicated people from all walks of life. We need people who are dedicated to public service and can provide the services we need in a high quality and efficient way. When we talk about a Medicare for All health care program and the need to make sure that all of our people have quality health care, it means that we need tens of thousands of new doctors and nurses and dentists and psychologists and other medical personnel who are prepared to practice in areas where people today lack access to that care. It means that we need hundreds of thousands of people to become child care workers and teachers so that our young people will get the best education available in the world. It means that as we combat climate change and transform our energy system away from fossil fuels, we need scientists and engineers and entrepreneurs who will help us make energy efficiency, solar energy, wind energy, geothermal, and other developing technologies as efficient and cost-effective as possible. It means that as we rebuild our crumbling infrastructure, we need millions of skilled and well-trained construction workers of all kinds. It means that when we talk about growing our economy and creating jobs, we need great business people who can produce and distribute the products and services that we need in a way that respects their employees and the environment. In other words, we need a new generation of people actively involved in public service who are prepared to provide the quality of life the American people deserve. Let me conclude by once again thanking everyone who has helped in this campaign in one way or another. We have begun the long and arduous process of transforming America, a fight that will continue tomorrow, next week, next year, and into the future. My hope is that when future historians look back and describe how our country moved forward into reversing the drift toward oligarchy, and how we move forward in creating a government which represents all of the people and not just a few, that they will note that to a significant degree, that effort began with the political revolution of 2016. Thank you all very much. Good night.
Okay.
Thank you, Bernie.
You said thank you, Bernie? Yes. Okay, let me do this underwriting announcement, please, Robert. Elliott Counseling Group has 35 counselors providing mental health services for individuals, families, couples, children, and groups. Evening and weekend appointments are often available immediately. Virtually all insurance, including state employee insurance, is accepted. There is also a self-pay sliding scale. You can contact Kevin Elliott or his staff at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That is ElliottCounselingGroup, counselinggroup.com, or 217-398-9066. And also, I did not do the disclaimer that these are my opinions and my views that are being expressed and not station WEFT. And the reason why, once again, why I wanted to play this Bernie Sanders, not because of being a Democrat or an independent or a socialist or a Republican, but I felt that what Bernie Sanders has to say is reflective of Higher Ground's mission, and that is to include everybody in the process and also to include everybody's thinking about how to improve to make our world, our community, a safer place for all of us to live in and a productive life for all of us to live in. And I feel that what he said here and making sure that that is imminent, preeminent, when the Democratic Convention takes place, that those persons who were actively participants in the campaign for Bernie Sanders, that the principles, the ideas that were espoused are in the forefront and not just so they get the vote. So it's more than just defeating anybody or about electing a particular person, but it's really about bringing about very necessary critical changes in this country.
Okay. Just listening and thinking about what you were saying.
Oh, you were thinking about what I was saying. I thought you had something to say. No? Okay, so we want to highlight some of the things because we have a guest that's going to be calling shortly.
Okay. That's true. So Bernie said a lot, but it really was saying for us to stop sitting and stop moving. He said movement, 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 multiple times, because it seems as if this political process that we are involved in, and initial, you know, people who wrote this constitution or defined this government said it was a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. If we were just observers and watching someone else do all the work and do all the everything, then what we get is what is related to how much we participate and put into it. He talked about contributions. He talked about everybody putting in so much money, but he also mentioned something about contributions as far as the effort, involvement in the process itself. The process of participating in a way that's more than just complaining. When we don't, and most of it's from the bottom up. So when we talk about the bottom up, we look at a pyramid where there's a single point at the top, which, you know, we can define as perhaps the president, you know, and the bottom, which we can define as all the millions of people in this country. Now, without those millions of people in the country, then that person at the top is pretty much not supported by much. So if we want things to be different. Then, in a different, in what way? Well, we're looking at the distribution of resources and power. You pointed out that millions of people in this country are dying. They're dying earlier. The life expectancy for the first time ever has decreased in this country. It had been growing. But for one time, my children have a lower life expectancy than I have. There's something wrong with that. And we can talk about why, too, if we need to right now. There are millions in jail, he said. And there are more people in jail in this country than the rest of the world. Why? Then millions in debt, you know, debt from going to school. So a person who, goes to school and graduates from college, he comes out with $40,000, $50,000, $100,000, $200,000 in debt, you know, and really, how can I express this? It changes the motivation for the effort. So a person who may want to be a lawyer and has good intentions, he wants to help people. He wants to, when he sees someone is being taken advantage of, or she may want to help these people. But the first thing that person must do is pay off his student loan. The only debt that in this country that we can't write off is student debt. So the motivation for people who want to be a lawyer now has to be, first, I got to pay off my debt. So they look at each person who comes to them as a person who's contributing to paying off their debt. So they may not want to work with the downtrodden, those people who don't have any money, because they can't help them to do what they want to do. So the money comes first. Or a healthcare institution that wants to help people who don't have health care. Now they can't do it. They won't do it because they first have to keep their doors open, I've heard. You know, so debt has a major contribution. And why are so many people in debt? Because we make it education, we make health care, we make all these things a profit, place for profit. And that comes first, not service. There was much discussion about government. You know, it says that the Republican and other conservative type of institutions want to decrease the power of government, eviscerate, he said. Well, government has a place. In this society, especially, and it has a place that has to be separated from religion. It has to be separated from big corporations. The bigger the religion, the bigger the corporation, the more important the government has to be there to support those people who could be affected by the power or the greed of these different institutions. You know. We were going to talk about some other things.
No, we won't. We have to do that another time, Robert.
You know, about how, you know, one group can take advantage of another group because they have more numbers. Well, who is going to support that group who has smaller numbers? It won't be the big group because they have their own interests at heart. It has to be some governing factor. And that government factor has to have some power. It has to be as big as, say, right now, if we were comparing it to corporation, the bigger and the stronger the corporations are, the bigger and stronger the government has to be to defend those who have very little power. And that, and one of the things about the you can see in our society is the people at the bottom, and I don't say bottom in a negative sense. I'm talking bottom in the sense of the numbers, the large amount of people involved, is that the drive is to divide. Let me repeat that. The drive is to divide, to keep the number of people separated in the small factions fighting each other over small bits of the of the resources, the more powerful the few are who are motivated to keep it that way. So we have to recognize our enemy is not each other, but our enemy is a division that separates each other. Whatever it is that divides us is our enemy. So the drive is to make friends. Our friend is the bottom, the people we go to the store, we sit on the bus with, we sit in a waiting room in hospitals. Those are our friends. These are people that we connect to. We share space, energy, electrons, everything with. And we have to manage, we have to cultivate, we have to husband those resources, and our greatest resource is each other. He says we must be involved. We have to contribute by our involvement. So, and most things are local. So if we have problems with the police force in this town, in your community, join the police force and police and reflect what's important within our community. I was just looking at just real quick, you know, it was a little thing on Facebook about President Reagan. He said, we must reject the idea that every time a law is broken, society is guilty rather than a lawbreaker. It is time to restore the American precept that each individual is accountable for his action. I say he's wrong. The reason why law is broken is because we have a law that was written by society that perhaps is not correct. The law that was written to cause a group of people to suffer is wrong. This is what Martin Luther King said in his letter from Birmingham Jail. These are bad laws. Say, for instance, a law that says, a certain chemical is wrong. And that law was written because it was trying to control a group of people. That law is wrong because it takes away from that person's ability to deal with a situation. Now, this particular chemical may be used because this person is unhappy with their state in life. If we change the state in life, that chemical becomes unnecessary. So there are many things that we can do by being more participatory in rather than just sitting back and waiting. So Bernie says, get involved, move, contribute, and we can work on the distribution of our resources.
Wow, Robert, you were on the roll there, and I had to, because I didn't manage the time as well. And so next time, well, I won't say next time, I have to say this time, I'm going to do that, because we have a caller calling in shortly, Dr. Jared Giannoli, and we're looking forward to hearing from him, and we will be discussing medical errors, which is very important. And why is it important? It's because we have too many of them.
We have too many of them. And they mean that there are people who are suffering from preventable problems.
Exactly. Exactly. So Dr. Gerard graduated from Tulane University with a degree in engineering and subsequently matriculated from Tulane University's medical school in 1986. He did an internship in general surgery and an internship in pediatrics, following a residency in
laryngology.
Head and neck surgery. He completed a fellowship in oncology, neurology,
otology,
right. Okay, there he is. He's calling. Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
Dr. Giannoli, doing good. Is this Eunice?
Yes, this is Eunice and Robert. Dr. Boone is here with me.
Oh, awesome.
So that's good. That makes the conversation even more better, I think.
Great.
Yes.
Right.
So how do you say your first name? How do you pronounce your first name?
Jared.
Jared. Okay. I kind of thought I had it correctly. So I was just reading here your bio, and Robert was correcting me as I was reading it. pronouncing the words wrong. Okay, so anyway, so let's see here. Otology, neurotology, and skull-based surgery at the Michigan Ear Institute. He's a full-time associate professor at Tulane Medical School until 2000 when he joined Ear and Balance Institute. He still maintains a clinical associate professor appointment at Tulane in both the Department of
Otolaryngology.
Thank you. Head and neck surgery. My tongue is not moving easily. And the Department of Pediatrics. He has published and lectured extensively in the field of neurotology and serves on multiple editorial review boards for the fields of neurotology and
otolaryngology.
Right. And today we're going to be discussing, yes. This is higher ground and it's okay. We're going to talk about a very important article that you wrote in the BMJ, which is the, what's the name of that magazine? What's the name of your, it was published there?
Actually, I didn't write the article in the BMJ. I wrote an editorial in response to the article.
Okay, got you. So you wrote the editorial, and this is what we have here, is the editorial response?
And that was put out by the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons.
Okay. And so your response to medical was titled is Medical Error, the Third Leading Cause of Death in the United States. And this is the Center for Disease Control has listed this as the third leading cause of death after.
No. Definitely not. And that's one of the misconceptions I need to point out.
Okay.
The CDC has said nothing about any of this. This was an article put out by two physicians at Johns Hopkins.
Okay.
And in their paper, and it was actually not a study, it was just basically an opinion piece.
Okay.
They were saying that they think the death certificates should have a place to check off for medical error death, and they estimate that the third leading cause of death was medical error. And my editorial basically say that's complete nonsense.
You're actually saying, rebutting that.
Correct.
That's your rebuttal, that you don't think it's due to medical error.
Correct. Well, I'll put it like this. Their methodology is extremely suspect.
Okay.
And just knowing, I've been in practice for 30 years, and I've sat in numerous morbidity and mortality conferences where we basically go over all the deaths and figure out why this patient died, what could we have done better. And to claim that there's that many medical error deaths, it just does not wash with my experience over the past 30 years.
Wow.
And then I can go into some detail as to why their study is nonsense, if you like.
Oh, definitely, because for sure I didn't get that. I didn't get that when I read it.
Well, this is what the study was. First of all, it was not a study. It was just, like I said, basically a commentary or an editorial on their part. And what they did was they looked at four previous studies that were done a while back between 8 and 16 years ago. So we're talking about looking at data that happened a long time ago.
Okay.
And in those studies, those were studies that were very limited studies looking at very small time period and very small groups of people. And they took the data from that and extrapolated it to the entire American hospitalized public.
Okay.
And so among those four studies, there were only 35 actual people that were records that were reviewed of people that had died that may have been from medical error death. And from those 35 deaths, they extrapolate to 250,000 people a year.
Out of
which
35.
Is a huge jump and very suspect. And if you go back and look at their methodology, it gets even more outrageous. And the first one is their definition of the word error.
Okay.
That they use.
So let's go over that error,
yeah.
The definition that they use that you think is faulty.
Well, they give three definitions, really, and it's this or this or this. And two of them are not bad, but one of them says medical error is one that does not achieve its intended outcome,
okay,
which is so overly broad that includes virtually anything to where it makes the term meaningless. For example, you know, my best friend had a lung condition that was going to be 100% fatal if he did nothing about it. And he was offered surgery to correct the condition and allow him to live, but the surgery came with about a 30% chance of death. Mm. He elected to have the surgery, which I think most people would, given his situation, and unfortunately he died from the surgery, after the surgery. And in that situation, everything was done correctly. Everything was done, it was by the best guys around, and it just, that is how sometimes things happen. We can have the best doctors that do everything right, and yet still the patient dies, and that is not an error. And I don't think most, the average reasonable person would call that an error, but according to their study, that's an error.
Hmm.
So right there, you have to wonder about what they're including in these studies.
Mm-hmm.
The second big thing...
Well, what they were trying to prove, period.
Oh, exactly. I think what they're trying to do, be honest with you, I think they're just trying to get more funding for their research more than anything else, or the author wanted to sell more books because he's got a book out there he's trying to sell.
Mm-hmm.
But the second thing is I went back and looked at those four... papers that they based their study on. And like I said, it was based on 35 deaths. Well, when I look at it, I can't find the 35 they're talking about. I can only find 14. So right off the bat, their numbers are wrong. And I went through those papers a couple of times to be sure I wasn't wrong. And I think somehow they made a mistake or something, but there's not 35 patients in there. The next big thing is the whole issue of extrapolation. Whenever you extrapolate from a small test or sample group to a much larger group, you have to make sure that the sample group is representative of the larger group. And I think a great example for that is if you're a fan of football like I am, is to look at Drew Brees. Okay, I apologize, but I'm a Saints fan. And Drew Brees is the all-time NFL pass completion record holder. Okay, but if you looked at just his pass completions on Hail Mary passes, you would see it's about 5% or less. And if you extrapolate that to his whole passing game, you'd say, oh, he's got about a 5% pass completion rate. And that would be just completely wrong. And so what they've done in their study is they've looked at a group that is the medical Hail Marys and trying to extrapolate that to the rest of the hospitalized public, because two of the studies included only people over the age of 65. Okay?
Mm.
Who dies in hospitals? It's our elderly that die in hospitals. So they're, of the people that die, 75% are people over the age of 65. So they're really just looking at the ones that are most critically ill and most likely to die, to the point where it really invalidates the use of an extrapolation in this particular situation.
Okay.
And then there's other problems with it too. For example, they use death certificates as their means of researching, and the problem with it is, and I know a lot of people that are not involved in medicine think death certificates, say why people die, but what studies have shown, death certificates are not much better than a guess as to why someone died.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you were to die right now, and Dr. Boone, being the last physician around you, had to fill out your death certificate, he would be just kind of guessing why you died.
Mm-hmm.
If he really wanted to know, he would say, we need to get an autopsy and have the pathologist look at you. And these are the doctors that's what they've dedicated their lives to doing, is figure out why people died. And so if they really want to know if there's medical error-related deaths and why people died, instead of relying on death certificates, they should be recommending autopsies.
On everyone.
Exactly. And so, if you really want to solve, what is the answer to this, you should do a prospective study and get autopsies on all these ones that are suspicious, and you can actually figure out why someone died and is it related to medical error or death. And the reason they're not advocating that is because it would show that it's nowhere near what they're saying. This is totally exaggerated and bogus.
I'm just kind of confused here.
I'm sorry.
No, not by you. I'm confused by
this particular article. And I can see your point here, because what is, you know, my thinking was after I read this thing, this article, was that there is a problem. And really, it is a problem in our healthcare system, you know. And much of it is based upon the profit motive, you know. Where, you know, how can I get money out of the system? And we don't address or spend enough of our resources keeping people from having to come to hospital in the first place. Much of our energy is focused on that 65-year and older group who are, you know, who are dying anyway. And when they do die, you know, most of the time, like you said, is the death certificate, you can say their heart stopped and they stopped breathing, so it's cardiopulmonary, you know, and I see that many times. You know, I've written that myself, you know, why they die. Well, I don't have an autopsy report. You know, I don't see, unless they were in an auto accident or whatever, that you know definitely they died of that or they had a definite pneumonia, you know, but reality is that they stopped breathing and their heart stopped beating. So that's sure. What the death certificate probably will say. And, you know, and most doctors say, what else could I say?
Absolutely. Well, I don't mean to imply that there's no problem. I mean, there's always problems. And, you know, if you ask me, are there deaths that are related to medical error? You know, I would have to tell you, I don't know for sure, but I would strongly suspect that's the case. But the problem is with such a silly, superficial study as they put out, I do not think it does justice the service of furthering patient safety.
Well, let me ask you a question, just being a patient myself, since I'm not a doctor, but I'm a patient myself.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I would be a patient. In reading this article, one of my concerns is, and I misunderstood it, because I'm thinking there is a basis here, and you're saying it's profit motive, because this is why it's being reported this way, using old information, research, data to support a concept so that they would get money. So how would they get money? For what?
Well, you know, I'll put it like this. Trying to figure out what someone's motive is
right.
can be very tricky. And I don't know for sure what their motive is. But I can tell you, I do know that the main author of the study
mm-hmm.
has a New York Times best-selling book out. And mm-hmm. this certainly will help sell his book. The other thing is his research is funded for looking for stuff like this. So making a buzz on this is going to increase his research, further his academic career, et cetera. It's going to give him gain. He's been on multiple talk shows since this paper has come out. And so it's one of these things where, you know, it's going to enhance his personal career is what I'm saying.
Well, that's very interesting. I'm just like, whoa.
But, you know, getting back to the whole problem that Dr. Boone pointed out, I mean, I agree there is a problem. But one of the things I would tell you, and this is to help quell some of this anxiety and hysteria, is that if you look at the total number of hospital deaths in America, you know, they don't mention that in the article, but the total number of deaths nationwide in all the hospitals is around 700,000 people, okay? And that has been declining over the last 15 years. You actually see a decline in the number of deaths in hospitals. And at the same time, during that same time period, you're seeing an older, sicker population being admitted to the hospital, and also the simpler, safer, less likely to die cases have been moved out to ambulatory surgery centers. So it's getting better in spite of higher risk patients being admitted. The other thing to keep in mind is it's estimated that about two-thirds to 70% of all deaths in hospitals are in patients who are DNR status,
do not resuscitate status,
which basically means the patient has told their doctor, you know, I've got such bad medical problems that if I start to die, don't stop me.
And that goes back to the same thing. the people that we see, and you know, I was misled. I can see what you're saying. This report that we read here, where they say, oh, they even implied that the surgery centers, were, they have this data. There's probably errors at those surgery centers that are the same level of percentage of people dying at the surgery centers that we don't even know about because they're not some of the data that the CDC has. So therefore, if you count the hospital deaths that we know about, we may know about, plus an unknown number that we don't know about, there's a huge problem.
Well, you see, that's the whole fallacy because everyone, they've led people to think that they actually counted up all the deaths. They did not count up all the deaths. All they did was an extrapolation as a percentage. And if they included all these low-risk things at the ambulatory surgery center, their percentage would go down and the numbers would come down. So it's actually the opposite of what they're saying. Mm-hmm. It's basically a scaremongering technique.
So
that's what it sounds like.
So as a patient, okay, so I have to come back being a patient. As a patient, I wouldn't read this report, but this person going on television and giving this data, then what we would hear the media as a public a person listening would be alarmed by the fact that there's a lot of deaths happening in hospitals. Okay, so what impact does that have on the consumer? This is what I want to know.
Well, that was my main concern. To be honest with you, if I came across this study, you know, just going through reading my journals, and I saw this, and that was it, I probably never would have even thought twice about it. I would say it's another article that's just kind of nonsense and just forget about it. The thing that prompted my action was seeing all the reports in the media and knowing how hysteria can cause some really bad effects. Like, for example, suppose you get sick, you don't want to go to the hospital because you heard the hospital is the place where people go to die because there's all these medical errors. And then you wind up delaying going to the hospital and you cause problems to yourself. One good example of hysteria incited by nonsense like this is the whole issue of the silicone breast implants. Back in the 70s and 80s, there was this big hysteria about silicone breast implants causing all kinds of medical problems. And it was the hysteria was whipped up by, believe it or not, the FDA, plaintiff attorneys, and the media. And what the result was, many women got silicone breast implants removed without any really good medical reason. A lot of plastic surgeons got sued for nonsense. Dow Corning, one of the huge medical device makers, went bankrupt. And years down, they've proved that this was complete nonsense. Silicone breast implants were completely safe. Now they're being used again because they've been proved they're safe and the whole thing was nonsense. And in the interim, we've also withheld these from women that needed breast cancer reconstruction work. So there was a lot of untold misery because of this hysteria.
I'm just kind of... okay, let me stuck here.
Okay, I can see. You know, we read the article, and from the article we kind of gleaned out some issues. You know that there is problems within our healthcare system, but at the same time we didn't see there was this motivation that we didn't know about by someone who's trying to drum up, hysteria, fear. And I can see how sometimes, just like right now, there's a big hysteria about sepsis in hospitals, and so we now have another guideline. We have more things that we have to pay attention to, more tests we have to run in order to define whether or not someone is septic. Well, I don't see it doesn't change the treatment so much so. That we're still going to give people IV fluids, we're still going to treat them with antibiotics because they're going to come in with fever and whatever. But now we have to order certain tests to prove they have certain degrees of sepsis where experienced doctors are going to look at patients and know by basis of experience and by how this, the vital signs and what else is going on, what these people really have and treat it accordingly anyway. But now there's another form, a layer of complexity that we have to deal with that really doesn't make our treatment of this patient change much. And as you already mentioned, the many of the people who come in who actually they were fearful of dying with sepsis were 80, 90-year-old people, who...
You touch on another interesting point, too, the added bureaucracy that doctors have to deal with because of these hysterias and government reaching in and micromanaging what doctors do. And a good example of that I would give you is the case of, remember, about a year and a half ago, there was a huge Ebola epidemic in Western Africa.
Yes.
And people started getting antsy about it in the United States. And there was a fellow that showed up in a Dallas emergency room who had just come from West Africa, exposed to people with Ebola, and he was starting to feel sick, and he was concerned that he may have Ebola. So he goes to the emergency room and tells the emergency room nurse, you know, look, I'm from West Africa. I've been exposed to Ebola patients. I think I might have Ebola. I'm starting to have these flu-like symptoms. The nurse dutifully documents in the electronic medical record all that he told them. The patient then gets sent back to the doctor. The patient assumes the doctor knows everything that the nurse put in the electronic medical record, not realizing that there's so much bureaucratic red tape and EMRs that the doctor is unaware of this. So the patient doesn't tell the doctor all the stuff he told the nurse. The doctor sees a guy that looks like he's got the flu and treats accordingly and then sends him out, almost starting a whole Ebola epidemic in Dallas. And here's a case where because the doctors and nurses are so inundated with bureaucracy with the electronic medical record that they can't get important information transmitted to one another.
Yep. Many times, even between doctors, we don't communicate very well.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, the EMR has done no service to improving that. It was supposed to improve that, but because there's so much useless information on there, I mean, as you know, you print out one of those EMR notes, it's 6 pages long, and there might be only 2 sentences worth of useful information in there. And so you got to read through 6 pages to find those two sentences of information, and that greatly slows down your day.
Much. And most of it's geared for the people in the billing department to gather statistics so they can bill. But most of it doesn't help us.
Yeah, the EMRs have been, instead of them being built to facilitate improved quality of patient care, they've been built with two things in mind. One is, like you said, for billing, and it's mainly for the hospitals to bill and get the most amount of money out of the insurers and Medicare. And the other is for our government to gather statistics on different things. And when they added both of those together, suddenly you've got a big pile of useless information that it's hard to glean what is important out of.
For sure. And the fact that we can't get that information. We can't get that information that we really need from, like, a patient went to one hospital today, especially if you live in a big city, they may go to 2 or 3 hospitals, and we can't get that information. We got people talking about HIPAA violations. You can't get this. You have to have a form filled out in order to get this. So by the time you've actually, and if you got work in the ER like I do, by the time you've gotten all this information, the patient is gone.
Gone where? You mean not in your presence?
He's not in my presence anymore. So it's not helpful. It's not helping me. I may want to have some information about what was previously done for this patient so I can make an assessment as to what I'm going to do next, but I won't have that information available to me. So the bureaucracy and the fact that we don't have a central database to get information doesn't help a lot. Except the billing department.
I don't want people to think I'm against technological change and the electronic medical record. I will tell you, my practice, it was the second practice in the state of Louisiana to have an electronic medical record. We had it in the early 1990s. But back then, the EMR was being geared toward improving patient quality and making sure you don't lose information. It got morphed once Medicare got involved, and then they started mandating different things, and it lost its way, and it's not achieving the goals that we had hoped it would be, which is the two big ones. One is transmission of information, and two, interoperability, meaning you can see my notes, I can see your notes, and everybody can see everybody's notes if they need to.
Yes.
And that is just not the case. It's actually entrenched those systems in their individual hospitals because they've spent so much money on them, and I don't see we're going to have interoperability anytime in the near future. As a matter of fact, I don't know if y'all are aware of this, but in the United Kingdom, where they have, it's a much smaller nation than ours. They have the National Health Service, which is all, socialized medicine there. They tried to implement a universal electronic medical records, and they did that for 10 years and spent billions and billions of dollars, or pounds, I should say, mm-hmm. and finally decided it's a worthless cause and just chunked the whole thing.
And why is that, Doctor?
Well, I think there's a lot of practical problems with it, and I don't remember the exact details as to why they gave up, but if they can't do it with having a socialized system where everybody's basically doing the same thing, I don't know how we're going to do it when we're so disparate with so many different types of insurance and practice and all that it just I just don't see we're going to be able to do it.
That's scary.
I got to take a breather on that one, too, because, I'm thinking that if we shared more information, if there was less competition between these entities, these systems, that perhaps even if there are preventable, there are deaths that are occurring and they're preventable, it would be preventable because of the fact that there's this system that works together, for the good of the patient. All right. And misinformation is also shared, as well as the information that is going to help to benefit the patient. You see, because I'm trying to understand here, this person writing this article, this book, or he has some sort of
study,
selfish reasons for doing this. And it definitely gets people, frightened and feared, and concerned about their health, because that seems to be a central concern in this country, is adequate health care. And also, is it affordable? And all of these things are so important. And then having doctors that you can actually see and are going to spend more than just a few minutes with you, but actually know you see, and then this feeling of in here as a consumer that there's this giant, system here that we don't really know much about it, but we're spending a great deal of money to support it. And we're also concerned about having access to it. And it's this unreason, it's this kind of weird, because I'm thinking if we share more information, Dr. Jarrett,
yes.
It's better for us. It's better for everybody if you share the mistakes as well as the good stuff you're doing.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. But at the same time, too, you want to make sure the information that's being transmitted is correct. Because if you transmit wrong information, you're just going to cause more problems. And with this article in the BMJ, it's wrong information. And if they really want to get a good idea of what's going on,
mm-hmm.
You really need to do autopsy studies to find out exactly why people died and what's the reason. Because then you've got something that's actionable. You can say, oh, it looks like this was a medication issue. We may find out that 90% of the medical error deaths were all due to medication issues, in which case then you can focus on what was the medication issue and drill down into what can we do to fix this to prevent this from happening in the future. On the flip side, you may find that it's not really such a big problem as we thought it was, and there's, you know, of course, one medical error death is too many, but at the same time, too, it's hard to justify putting a lot of resources behind a problem that's minuscule compared to other things like people dying of cancer or dying in car accidents, et cetera. But really what you want is you want to get some truthful information, not someone's exaggeration to generate grant funds for themselves.
But isn't that how things are run in this, you know, a lot of times, Dr. Jared? I mean, I get what you're saying, but as a consumer who's not going to read this article, we're not going to know about it. You know, we're not going to know that this is being done. As a consumer, how do I know what is so, what is not so? I don't know, do I?
No. You have to rely, and that's the thing. You have to rely on what the media tells you or what the scientific journals tell you.
Exactly.
And one of the problems, and this is a whole other issue, but there is a significant problem with information in the scientific journals as just flat out wrong, like this BMJ article. There's an interesting interview with the editors-in-chief of the two of the most prominent medical journals in the world, the New England Journal of Medicine and Lancet, and both of the editors said, you know, roughly probably about half of what is in medical journals right now are just flat-out wrong.
Mm-mm-mm.
Yeah, and part of it is because if you're in academia, like the two guys that that put out this paper from Hopkins, you are under a lot of pressure to publish. Yeah, I don't know if you've heard of the term, the saying, "publish or perish."
Oh yeah.
Because if you don't publish, you lose your creds in academia and you lose your pathway to a successful career. So you are under a lot of pressure to put out papers. Okay. And in general, you want to kind of go along with what you think people are going to accept, what people are going to think is correct. And so regardless of whether it is the right thing to do, you're going to put something out there that you think people are going to accept. And that is a problem because it doesn't necessarily reflect the truth. It also doesn't necessarily advance the scientific knowledge. In my a specific field, neuro-otology.
And you know, please explain what that is, neuro-otology.
We deal with inner ear disorders, vertigo, dizziness, hearing loss.
Now, does that have anything to do with multiple sclerosis also?
We do see occasionally patients with multiple sclerosis that have balance problems, but that's really more the area of the neurologist.
Okay.
But what I was going to say is, you know, if you look at my field, where the major advances have come, they have not come from academic medicine. Most of the major advances have actually come from guys in private practice. For example, the cochlear implant. I know most people have heard of cochlear implants at this point. This is a device where you can insert a multi-electrode array into the inner ear and basically give hearing to the deaf. Well, when that was developed by this guy, Bill House, in private practice, all the guys in academics told him that this was malpractice, you know, it's an assault on people to shove a wire in someone's ear, et cetera. And it wasn't until he had really pushed it through that they finally started accepting and refining the device. There's multiple other examples I can give you in my field that are just like that, developed by guys in private practice, criticized by the guys in academics and in the universities, and this is why you're not seeing the major advances coming out of the universities. Now, the universities do a great job at refining those radical transformative ideas once they're out there, but as far as bringing them out, they're somewhat hesitant to do that because they don't want to lose their academic creds.
I'm dizzy.
And they may be concerned about what they're teaching their students, you know, and they wanted to have things that are laid out and tried and true for decades and not really be out on the forefront of the person in the clinic who says, I'm going to try this because what else is there? You know, and this patient who has a condition, say they can't hear, you know, and you know what the life is going to be like with a person who can't hear, And so this practitioner says, you know, I've been doing a little studying. I got a little thought about this and talked to the patient's parents or whatever and said, why don't we give this a try? And he tries it and it works a little bit. Then he gets some, tries it on another person. Now academia can get involved in refining it to specifics as far as how much, you know, where it's got to be placed and how much energy is it going to require, so forth. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell you an interesting story. I remember, now this is going to date me a little bit, but when I was a surgery intern, I remember listening to a grand rounds presentation, which is a big lecture in front of the entire department and all of the professors, and they invited this guy who is in private practice locally who had been doing this new technique called laparoscopic surgery.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what it was just make a little tiny, you know, 1-inch incision, sticking a scope in there and doing your surgery through the scope.
Mm-hmm.
And this was radical because everybody else was making these big, giant belly incisions and doing everything under direct visualization. And once he gave his presentation, and I was just so impressed. It's like, wow, that's so much better than what they're teaching me here. All the professors got up and said, this is just outrageous. This is dangerous. You're going to have patients hemorrhaging all over the place, and you're going to be killing people. And the private practice guy just calmly got up at the end and said, you know what, y'all can criticize this as much as you want, but I guarantee you within the next 5 to 10 years, you're all going to be doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And he was absolutely right. And it's another example of the radical transformative idea coming from outside of academia.
Okay, being a consumer and also a movie enthusiast, old movies at that, and you know, Dr. Welby and Ben Casey, and trying to think which other ones. Oh, another one came out, The Nick. I don't know if you've seen The Nick.
I have not. I want to see it though.
Well, it's on hiatus right now, but they have a couple of seasons of it. You probably could see it on
YouTube or,
but you know, this was like 18 Hulu. What is it, early 19 something medical profession, where they were trying everything out, and you know, because there was not a lot of techniques, you know, other than just experimental kind of thing. Do you think that we don't trust the medical profession like we used to? Is it too much information we have? Before you go to the doctor, when I was growing up, went to the doctor knew, you know, you trusted the doctor. You know, most of the time we trusted our family doctor, and he was going to take care of us and he was going to treat everything. You know, he was a urologist. That was our family doctor. And, but he was going to take care of everything. But today, I don't know. Do we trust the medical profession? Like, do we really, as a consumer, do I trust the medical field? I know it's like it's there, and everybody says, well, we got to have a doctor. You need to have a doctor. You should be prepared just in case you get sick to go to the doctor. But do we trust them anymore? This is my question.
I think that's a great question. I think what's happened is medicine has become a victim of its own success.
Mm.
You know, you think about it, go back 20, 30, 40, 50 or more years, you know, medicine was not very successful in doing a lot of things. There was very limited what you could do in medicine. The more successful medicine has become, the more people have expected out of medicine.
Mm-hmm. The greater expectation to be successful 100% of the time.
Absolutely. And at this point, the major media has portrayed this image of medicine as being, well, you know, you go to the doctor, he fix you up, and if you don't get fixed up, well, there is something wrong. And the problem is that's not reality. Medicine is still not a hard science like we have with, you know, engineering. Medicine is still much an art, and like I said earlier in the program, you can come in with a problem per se, and everything can be done by the book, by the best doctors around. And you can still die, and we don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reality. Medicine is not perfect. You can name any condition, any problem, and there is a certain percentage that are not going to be successful. That's just how it is.
And we don't get to learn. And you mentioned autopsies more than once. It's rare that unless it's an auto accident or somebody got shot out in the field, We don't get autopsies. You know, so,
oh, absolutely.
So we don't
learn.
That
back in the 1970s, we had hospitals had a near 50% autopsy rate. Now it's less than 5%.
You know, and you can remember when we were in probably about the same time as a resident, you know, I had to go in to talk to the parent, the family, and say, we need to get an autopsy. You know, the dead teach the living. That was the story we would tell them. So that we can, and we had, you know, pathology residents, too. So they had to have patients to learn from. So we would tell the family, you know, we're going to do an autopsy. We'll find out the true reason why this person died, so you can learn. You know, maybe these things run in families or whatever. You know the story.
Oh, that's an excellent point. And you know, for your listeners, I would have them go see that movie Concussion with Will Smith.
Okay.
Yes.
And in the story, he plays the part of this doctor that. If it wasn't for the doctor is a pathologist, and what he does is he does autopsies. And if he would not have done an autopsy on Mike Webster's brain, mm-hmm. we would not know the whole issue of concussions in the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that all came from an autopsy.
Mm-hmm. And I remember Mike Webster from a while ago.
And there's a lot of other examples. For example, there was a. You know, what? One of the things that led to a lot of the anesthesia monitoring that has made surgery much safer was an autopsy study of this patient that died inexplicably during surgery. They brought the patient for the autopsy. The autopsy revealed that the endotracheal tube was not in the trachea but in the esophagus.
Yes.
And that led to the development of monitoring devices to figure out, oh, is the endotracheal tube in the right place and stuff.
Mm-hmm. So do we have
an autopsy?
So do we, as the consumer, do we have an aversion to the idea of someone cutting on our loved one's body? You know, now that they're dead, we don't want you looking at them like that, unless there is a malpractice concern about malpractice, but. Do we want to know, do we want you looking at our bodies afterwards like that?
Well, that is one of the problems. There's two issues that have prevented autopsies from being done. One is the reticence of the family to have their loved ones undergo an autopsy. The whole idea is they think, well, you know, grandma has been through too much. We don't want her to have that done to her. Okay. The second problem, and this one might even be a bigger problem, is cost.
Yes.
Okay, because nobody wants to pay for it. It's not covered by health insurance, obviously. The hospitals don't want to pay for it. Who's going to pay for it?
Yes.
And so a lot of autopsies don't get done because of cost as well. Now, you know, there are certain situations that Dr. Boone was referring to that they have to be done if someone dies under... You know, certain circumstances, law mandates that an autopsy has to be done to figure out why they died, to make sure there was no foul play involved. But outside of that, it really kind of becomes, whether the family agrees to it or not, and then also the funding.
And they would have to pay for it.
Exactly.
Family has to pay for it.
You know, another high-profile death that I was surprised did not have an autopsy was when Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia died.
Hmm.
I don't know if y'all remember this,
yes.
But he died in this hotel room mm-hmm. in some place in the middle of nowhere in Texas, I believe,
mm-hmm.
and was by himself, and just the maid comes in and finds him dead in his bed.
Hmm.
And the thing is, you know, it's like that mm-hmm. situation, I think, in most counties, they would have done an autopsy,
mm-hmm.
but the family didn't want an autopsy, so they didn't do it. So, you know, he probably died by why they wrote on the death certificate, but you don't know for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you felt like that was questionable because it was out in some obscure place, and he's a Supreme Court justice, and perhaps maybe there was something, maybe, but that the family didn't want it.
Exactly. Well, the thing is, I'm just surprised that it wasn't mandated by the local laws, because I'm pretty sure if it would have happened in my county, it would have been a coroner's case where they would have to do it.
Because he's a Supreme Court
justice.
But
the laws vary from one place to another.
Because he died outside the hospital.
Right. Yeah, if he was in a hospital, there would have been no issue. Mm-hmm. But being alone in a hotel room, and being such a high-profile person, you can't exclude the possibility of foul play.
Right. Now, his doctor, if he was a person who had end-stage cancer, he was dying, and he died at home, then autopsy might not be done because the family doctor would say, we expected death. But this was one that was unexpected.
Mm. Correct. Yeah, I think that's the thing. Unexpected is the big actionable word.
Okay. Let me ask you another question. This we have Dr. Jared Giannoli on the air today with us. This is WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. I don't even think I did that at the top of the hour. I forgot to do that today. But I want to ask you a question. This is a kind of a personal question about you as a doctor. Where are you in terms of the medical profession, in terms of, what is doing in terms of training and preparing doctors to be doctors, future doctors, the whole healthcare thing, cost factors, playing a really big factor on how data is collected, making sure data is accurate, the pressure on professionals to maintain their status in the career. There's this profit kind of, motivation for so many things now. Where are you, doctor?
Well, that's a great question. And I'll tell you, I've taken a very strong stance here, in that about 11 years ago, I got rid of my last insurance contract, and my practice is completely 100% what we call third-party free. We have no contracts with any insurance company, Medicare, Medicaid, no one. We deal exclusively with our patients and our patients only, so that we don't take any direction from, we don't work for the insurance company, in other words. And, a lot of people think of that as like, well, gosh, that would lead to much more expensive fees. And the issue is it's actually the opposite. I can charge significantly lower prices because I don't deal with any of the insurance companies. In fact, my prices are anywhere from a third to one-tenth of what my competitors are.
Wow.
Because I don't deal with the insurance companies.
So give me an example when you say a third. What would it cost me to come see you for the first time?
Well, to give you an idea, because I don't deal with the insurance companies, I can spend as much time as I need to with you.
Okay, so how much is it going to cost me for you to spend that first appointment with me?
First, I'll tell you what you'll get from my competitors. You'll get 5 or 10 minutes in the office.
I know. I go. I'm a consumer, remember?
And you'll pay $180.
Okay, so $180. So a third of that.
Okay. If you come to see me, I will spend over an hour with you. And it'll be $395.
Okay, so is
that... So it's more expensive.
It's more expensive.
But on a per-time basis, a whole lot less expensive.
Yes. Okay, so wait, I got another question. A lot of us are concerned, and I, myself, we pay my insurance, and it's very expensive. And I'm not taking any medication. I don't have any illness that I know about. And yet every month we're paying this large amount of money because I'm self-employed for my insurance.
Right.
And that's every month because of this concern that if I get sick, we don't want to be bankrupt. We don't want to lose our house. We don't want to lose it. You know what I mean? And we have to go in the hospital. So how do you do that?
Well, you're thinking of insurance in the way that you should think of insurance. You're not thinking of it as a means to fund your health visits. You're thinking of it as a means to avoid financial calamity.
Right.
Which is how most people should. The problem is insurance has morphed into a healthcare payment plan. And a lot of people think insurance is going to bargain down and get the best price they can for me. But they're not.
No.
They don't care how much things cost. just as long as your premium pays more than what they're paying out. And I'll give you a great example of that. This is about a month or so ago. A new couple has a brand new baby, and the parents are clipping the baby's fingernails for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And clip them a little too close, and you know it's a very vascular area, and the baby starts bleeding.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So they freak out, and they go to the emergency room.
Yes.
They get to the emergency room. They're immediately brought back to the emergency room doctor, who looks at the baby calmly, puts the baby's finger under the sink, washes off the blood, and then puts a Band-Aid and says,
"Oh my goodness,
it's real vascular there. You know, just don't cut them so short." And then they send them home.
Yes.
Course, so how much
about
is it?
2 months later, they get the bill.
Listen.
For $650.
Yes.
For the five minute visit in the ER and the Band-Aid.
And the Band-Aid.
But don't worry, they have insurance.
How much did they pay?
Well, their insurance is, of course, a $3,000 deductible, so anything
they haven't spent yet.
To pay for.
Mm.
And the insurance rate is bargained down to $450 for that Band-Aid in 5 minutes.
Isn't that something?
And it just goes to show you, the insurance company doesn't care how much it pays, just as long as you pay for that plus their profit on the end. Whereas if you would have gone to one of these doctors that does direct patient care, where they charge fee for service, it might have cost $5 total for the doctor's time and the Band-Aid.
A lot of them would have probably done it for free. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So help us. Help me, the consumer, who is now a little bit irritated more because they will find, and I've had Robert, oh my goodness gracious, they will find in a bill, insurance will pay so much, but whatever that little amount the insurance didn't pay, if it's $5, $10, $20, along with the copay, they're going to send you a bill. Very
right.
rarely are you going to go to the doctor and not get a bill, even though
you have insurance.
Your insurance
right,
covered
right.
most of it.
Well, I think the biggest thing I would tell people is, before you go to the doctor, ask how much it's going to cost.
Mm-hmm.
And ask for a cash price.
Okay.
Now, look, I'll give you an example. Let's say you're going to get a mammogram.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if you get a mammogram done and the insurance company decides that they're going to deny payment on that mammogram,
mm-hmm.
you're going to get charged the full charge, which is going to be about $400.
Okay.
Okay. So you'll get a bill in the mail, and they'll be demanding $400 from you.
Okay.
All right. However, if they do agree to pay for it,
mm-hmm.
they're going to pay somewhere between $130 and $250 for that mammogram. Okay? Or that's the contracted price. And if you've got a high deductible plan,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have to pay somewhere between $130 and $250.
Okay.
However, if you go ahead of time and get a cash price,
mm-hmm.
especially during Breast Cancer Awareness Month,
okay,
you'll pay $40 to $50.
At the same hospital?
The same place.
Oh, wow.
Same place.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom line is, the unit that's doing the mammogram would rather have that $50 cash in
mm-hmm.
hand
mm-hmm.
than a promise that they might get paid $400 down the road
mm-hmm.
by someone who may or may not pay them, by an insurance company that may deny the payment
mm-hmm.
or that may take some crazy discount. Plus, think of it this way. Suppose they accept your insurance and the insurance is going to pay them $130
mm-hmm.
and they pay an employee $20 an hour to fight with the insurance company to get that money, and they
right.
spend 4 hours on the phone with the insurance
mm-hmm,
company,
mm-hmm.
they've just wasted $80 of their $130.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
mm-hmm.
pretty close to that $50, $40.
Yeah.
So
they'd much rather do,
mm-hmm.
they'll do $40, $50
mm-hmm.
Mammograms for cash all day and be happy mm-hmm. as clams.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying, this is what you would suggest. You would suggest as a consumer to shop around for a doctor that would charge you fee for services?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot of them. There's more and more of them doing it. Not all of them will do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just doctors, but also for lab tests,
mm-hmm.
for x-rays. I can get, for example, what do you think an MRI scan costs?
Just
$1,000, $2,000, $3,000 MRIs.
Yeah, probably if you get charged after the fact, it's going to be in excess of $3,000.
Okay.
I can get you MRI scan cash price $350.
Wow.
For any kind of MRI you want, I can get you for $350 because I bargained those prices for my patients.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, labs, blood tests.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a CBC, if you just go get it done, it's going to be $100-something to get it done. If you get the cash price in advance, you can get it for like $2.
So would I – okay, so let's say that I'm under insurance and I go to certain providers are provided for me to use. I can ask those providers in advance, ask them how much they are charging me for those things,
would I have to go to
a fee-for-service doctor?
Right. What you need to do is you can ask them, do you offer discounts for cash price patients who don't have insurance? And don't use your insurance.
Okay.
Because if you tell them you got your insurance,
yep.
They have to give you the insurance price.
And that's a bunch of crockola, of course, because the insurance company doesn't want to pay what the doctor is going to charge, what the hospital or clinic is going to charge, and then they're going to pass that on to you, the consumer.
Yeah. I found this out 14 years ago was the first time I found this out, when my wife was pregnant with our last child, and I didn't realize we didn't have maternity coverage with our insurance.
Mm.
And I thought we did, so I was really upset with the insurance agent and kind of yelled at him because I thought he had pulled a fast one on me. And he said, sorry, doc, you know, there's nothing I can do. I said, okay. So I called the hospital and said, okay, do you have a cash price for delivery of a baby? Okay, it was $900 for everything, soup to nuts, everything, the 24-hour stay in the hospital, delivery and everything. I'm like, okay, here's the $900. I wrote him a check and sent it in advance of the delivery. I then, about a week or two later, get a letter from the insurance company saying, gee, we're so sorry about the misunderstanding. Please use this letter as a negotiating technique with the hospital that maybe they'll give you our insurance negotiated fee of $1,500.
Mm-hmm. Wow. But it was less.
Laughed at him.
But it was less than. It was probably less than what they would have charged off the top if they had not said we made an error and use this letter as a negotiating fee, because that's pretty low, isn't it? $1,500.
More than if we would have just gone in, done no negotiation ahead of time, gone in and then got charged after the fact.
Right.
It would probably have been $5,000.
Exactly. Okay, I know. Yeah. It's time to go. I have to go, Doc.
You had negotiated a rate of $900.
Right. Now, I want to ask you a question. Is there an agency or is there a website or anywhere where we can go to look for doctors who are fee-for-service? What is that?
AAPSonline.org.
AAPSonline.org. Okay.
And that's the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. They have a database of doctors that do strictly cash fee-for-service.
Okay. Hey, I would love to have you on again because I've got questions. Now, how do I get in contact with you? If I wanted to call you and talk to you, could I call you?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
What's your number?
985.
There's enough time for a disclaimer.
809-1111.
985 what?
809-1111.
I just want to talk to you about some personal questions I have.
Sure,
okay?
Sure.
All righty. Thank you so much, Dr.
Did you get the area code?
Yeah, 985. Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Giannoli. Is that
my
Italian?
Pleasure. Enjoyed speaking with you guys.
Is that Italian?
Yes, ma'am.
All righty. I got that right. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.